Greetings. Greetings and salutations, people of Earth. This is, of course, the Bigfoot Show, episode number 62. Refugium X is the title of this one, and you will find out as you listen to it why I call it that. If you are a listener to Seth Breedlove's excellent Sasquatch podcast, then you may have already heard a preview, more than a preview to this episode, since most of, not all, but a lot of what we talked about on that show is also included here, except you hear it from the mouth of some of the people who actually lived it, as opposed to hearing it from me and Daryl Collier. I hope you enjoy this one. I'm not going to give a big preamble to this. I'm just going to jump right into it, and then I'll come back at the end with a little bit of a recap. This was recorded back in September at the annual North American Wood Ape Conservancy retreat that we conduct every year. And you'll hear, as usual, interviews with people who help run the organization, as well as some eyewitness accounts. So without further ado, we'll jump right into it, and I will talk to you again when it's over. So I'm sitting here, and we're overlooking the... What am I looking at here, Paul? What is this out here?
That is the western skyline of Okmulgee County.
And the sun has just set, and I can see for many, many miles. There's not a cloud in the sky. It's absolutely beautiful out here tonight. And, of course, we are at the third annual NAWAC member retreat. And as we've done in previous years, we're going to do a little sort of summer recap for what the NAWAC has done this year. And as usual, I have with me Elton Higgins, who's the chairman of the group. I have Daryl Collier, who's the field coordinator, and Paul Bowman, who's the vice chairman. And so we're going to sit here and talk a little bit about how the summer went. And I want to start with you, Daryl. Did we get a wood ape this year?
No, we did not get a wood ape.
That's the first question people are going to want to have that answered.
And that is a good question. It's a fair question. And no, we did not. But I will say that we came close again, but didn't happen. You know, but Alton gave an interesting presentation today about conservationist Jim Corbett, who worked for decades trying to achieve his goals. So we've only been actively trying to obtain a specimen for 4 years. So we are just beginning. It's just starting. So and we came close, and we have no reason to believe that next year we will not be successful. We've learned some things, and part of the session today included brainstorming and having discussions about how to tune our craft and get better at this and bring to bear some of the new knowledge that we have, and some new tech, and we're going to put it to use next year with Operation Resolute next summer.
It's one of those things that I get asked a lot, like, well, when are you gonna get one? And I'm like, well, when it happens, because there's really no way to. There's equal parts effort and luck and everything else. Alton, you found some inspiration in what Corbett had written. What were some of the things that you thought were applicable to the work that we do? And tell me a little bit more about him.
Yeah, Jim Corbett was an Englishman that was born and raised in India, and he served in the military there. He was widely known for his knowledge about wildlife, and he was turned into quite a conservationist in his youth. He loved to hunt and learned a lot, as I said, about the cultures that were there. He spoke all the dialects and what have you, and somehow the military, I guess, became aware of his expertise and his background, and so he was often called upon to hunt down man-eating tigers and leopards. And so he wrote books. He was an excellent writer, and he wrote some books that detailed his exploits. And as I was reading, I read the book, his books as a child, and then I reread them just recently. Travis Lawrence brought an omnibus of his writings and lent me the book, and I reread the stories and found some inspiration, as you say, in the things that he wrote, you know, the way that he operated and his philosophy. So that's what I talked about today, was some of the points that I took from that.
But I think that the interesting thing that I took from what he said is that he wasn't always successful. He was considered to be one of the most successful, as you said, man-eating tiger hunters, which is, that's a really cool thing to be, a really good thing at. But he was considered to be one of the most successful of his time, but he was often not successful.
Yeah, it sometimes took him many, many tries and long, many months of effort, a year sometimes, to finally, you know, shoot one of these creatures. They were exceedingly intelligent. He said, we underestimate the intelligence of animals. And he said that all these people that failed before him, one of the things that that characterized their failure was that they weren't patient enough. You know, that they didn't really have the discipline to put in the time to endure the sits that are required to capture or to shoot one of these creatures. And so I think that applies to us as well. You know, it takes a lot of patience, and he never gave up. He would keep after it. So that was one of the points I tried to emphasize.
So Paul, from your perspective, what's your take on the year that we've just concluded?
Well, you know, I've come to the conclusion, actually in the last few weeks, that I used to be a glass is half empty kind of person, and I realized I'm actually a glass needs a refill kind of a person, if you know what I mean. Preferably with a single malt scotch. but I was disappointed, of course. I always have. I've learned since I had my sighting and since, you know, just all the experiences that we've had, I've always thought that we are so close. We are right there. We are on the very verge of making this happen. And then when it doesn't happen, I'm filled with utter disappointment. if I may, we had a large event here last weekend, a big motocross race.
Here being we're at the Bowman Lodge.
Yes, here at the ranch, and it was a charity race, and some of the guys came back today to help clean up the course, the dirt track that they made. And so I wanted him, one of them was a veteran, and I wanted him to meet Daryl. And so I just basically had to tell him, you know, who was here today. And that's not a five-minute conversation, you know, to describe the, you know, Nawak. And so, and it dawned on me, you know, and I said to him, I said, you know, as I say these words to you and as I give you a few stories about what's happened down there in that Valley of the Apes, to any person that's not either a friend or family member or a member or is knowledgeable about our experiences, it sounds utterly ridiculous. It sounds fantastically impossible. Yet we've experienced these things, and we've seen them with our own eyes. We've heard them. I mean, it's very, very real. And so all that's really done is it's sort of tempered the sword, so to speak, for me. Because we are the only people that are actually doing this. And it almost doesn't matter if anyone believes us or not. Yeah. And I finally reached that point. It's almost a spiritual awakening where you realize, I don't care if you believe me. I don't even have to tell you what we're doing. You can laugh. That's right, because I'm not. I mean, we're doing this for the world. We're doing this for the species. We're doing this for, you know, hopefully, ultimately, the ultimate conservation of habitat, of not only for them, but all the animals and wildlife that exist with them. So you don't have to believe what I believe and what I know to be true. And there again, I've spoken before about that word belief, and I can't stand using that anywhere in the context of the Wood Apes. But I think this year really, you know, upon further reflection, I've realized that it's just we are the only people on the ground doing this, and we have the patience, we have the tenacity, we have the resolve, we have the endurance to continue this project. And so time is really on our side. It's difficult from, you know, because everyone takes time away from their families. Everyone kind of expects it to happen. This is the summer. This is when it's going to go down, you know. And then when it doesn't happen, it's very disappointing. But nobody else is doing this, and it doesn't matter.
As far as we know, I mean, if someone else is in a position that this group is in, they're not saying anything about it publicly. But, yeah, as far as we know.
If I may add one more thing, what I told this guy is that I just kind of gave him a brief background of some of the highlights of what we've done in the last 4 years. But it dawned on me the incredible amount of knowledge. And I never, ever would have guessed that we would have been able to obtain so much raw intelligence and knowledge about. I mean, it just, you know, we've talked about this in the past about how everyone speculates, well, they're nocturnal, or well, they, you know, they migrate in the winters. I mean, it's just pure speculation. We actually have hard data in my mind, and that it almost boggles the mind how much we've learned in the last four summers, and it's frankly incredible. And in fact, I was telling one of our members, Mike Mays, today about two of the sightings that are within 10 miles of this location. And one of them was a geologist that is about 8 miles northeast of here. And he saw what he described as a large chimp-like creature hanging from a tree. You know, and 5 or 6 years ago, that would have been sort of a report to me anyway of befuddlement. It's like, well, maybe that was a wood ape. I mean, that's not the usual paradigm for Sasquatch reports. Right?
People still aren't talking. We're the only ones talking about these things being in trees because we've seen them in trees.
Well, now, not only has the tree aspect come into play, but now the small chimp-like description has come. It's like, and now it's like we can actually backtrack to some of the sightings that go back, you know, decades. Right. And it suddenly makes sense now.
Yeah, well, I'm going to talk to Travis Lawrence here at some point if I can find him. And he had a incredible encounter this past summer that involved small chimp-like things. Daryl, from your perspective as the Field Operations Coordinator, tactically speaking, what were some of the things that we thought would be helpful or profitable this year, I guess is a way to put it, but turned out just not to work for us?
Well, I think the primary thing was the modification we did to Overwatch. Last year we had we provided Overwatch from a ground blind, just very close to the cabin. We believed that if we somehow elevated Overwatch, it gave us a higher position, that it would somehow help us. It would give us a wider field of view, and many of us went into this year with every bit of confidence that it was going to happen because of the new Overwatch. And we did try a new Overwatch. We built a tower. The Overwatch blind was about 12 feet off the ground.
It was much more comfortable. It was much better suited for.
It had padded floors, and the swivel seats were yeah. I mean, awesome. Literally just.
And the padded floor, as opposed to last year, which were rocky and pointy, the padded floors this year was for quiet. It was to make it quiet.
Right.
And if I may, even the attention to detail of having the glow in the dark tape that had on the floor that had the cardinal directions, that helped me immensely. Yeah. The few nights that I sat in the new Overwatch, because you get so disoriented in the pitch black and you're looking into a thermal scope and you can look down while you still have eye on the glass, you can actually look down with your other eye and say, okay, I'm facing north now. Because when you're spinning around.
Well, and you've also got a shamog over your head to keep the light from escaping from the thermal.
Exactly.
So, yeah, so you're definitely in total darkness, and those glow letters really helped. Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, the Overwatch Tower did not lead to the success we hoped it would. And we're still working on putting our finger on what the shortcomings were. But we're going to modify it again this next year. We're going to augment it. But suffice to say that, and we had a great discussion about this today, that we believe there are some weaknesses to that we're going to try to overcome next year.
So what do you think it is? I mean, it's from a tactical standpoint, from our perspective, it's better because we're higher up. Yeah. We have better field of view. It's more comfortable. You can sit in there and you're not as fatigued. But what's the flip side? What did we give up?
Well,
totally on your opinion, because of course we don't know what the apes are thinking.
Yeah, I mean the tower sticks out like a sore thumb. I mean it sort of becomes the focus. I think it sort of becomes the focus of everything, a person, when you walk into this area, this cabin, the first thing you see is the tower. That's the first thing you see. And
well, we had incidents where the apes actually threw rocks at people
tower.
In the tower.
Yeah.
So it's like it exactly. I mean, it was like a beacon.
Yeah, and so if you're in that tower and you're not observing light and noise discipline, that is, if you're not staying quiet, if you're using headlamps and you're making all kinds of noise and stuff, well, then, you know, your position's given away. I mean, it's obvious that someone is up there doing something. So whatever it is, there's a possibility that they were onto us up in that tower. And, you know, we had a number of examples where we were not on overwatch, and we had things coming up to the cabin, up to the porch, on the porch. But when we were up in overwatch, it seems like they kept their distance. So,
which is not unlike what happened with last year's Overwatch, but I think last year we had more opportunities, we had more instances where we felt they came in and we actually had thermal hits of what were probable apes, but this year we had maybe one, that's it.
Last year we had several that were definite visuals. This year we had no definite visuals from Overwatch, and we had one possible.
The animals were still coming close. Insofar as, you know, 30, 40, 50 yards away, whatever. But they weren't coming into view. They were keeping their distance. So it might have been a result of some suspicion regarding the Overwatch Tower. You know, it wasn't that they stayed away. They still approached.
They're still throwing rocks. I mean, we had guys up in Overwatch getting rocks thrown at them while they're in Overwatch. They try to look through, and that's part of the weakness with thermals. People think the thermal is just, it's the panacea. I mean, it is the answer, but it has its limits. It can't see through vegetation, and where we are operating is like a North American rainforest. The vegetation is just unbelievably dense, and you can have something 30 yards away from you, but there's just this thick understory and trees that are between you and it, and you can't see it.
So, I mean, this is, and I guess as I'm listening to us talk about this, I don't want to get too hung up on the fact that no specimen is collected, because that makes it sound like we're worried that, well, we failed. And clearly we did not fail this year, because there were so many other things that we learned and experienced along the way. So,
let me just say that we actually had, what was it today? Eight, we counted, part of our data presentation, we counted 18 visuals. Encounters, where our investigators had visual observations, personal visual observations in the field, hard contact with the target species, and 18 possible visuals. That is where they saw a piece of an animal that, you know, just by a process of elimination, you could kind of probably say that's what they saw, but because they didn't really see any true identifying markers, then we have to list it as sort of a possible. So. Oh, there were plenty of close contacts. I mean, the Brian, you and I were on the last team this year, Quebec team. The next to the last day, I had an opportunity to shoot one, and it moved. It just moved just in the nick of time to keep me from putting a round into it.
And this is what I'm going to say. So people are going to hear, because I know, as they've asked me this on the internet before, but 36 times, you're going to say you saw 36 wood apes over the course of the summer. Where's your picture, and why didn't you shoot one?
Well, because I only had, each time that I saw one, I only had 1.5 to 2 seconds. Any of you who can step into a jungle and be on a ground blind and have an animal step out at 50 yards, it's gone. Now, where's your camera and where's your gun?
I mean, that's the hallmark.
That's it. It steps out, it's gone. You're walking down the trail, it goes across the trail in front of you. Why don't you get a picture? Why can't you shoot it?
That as well, because my sighting last year, I mean, no one is more disappointed and sort of befuddled by that as I am, because I've always been the biggest critic of our own members. You know, why didn't you shoot it? You know, and you know, so I sort of had to eat crow. But given the context, and believe you me, I am a shooter. Okay, I will not hesitate. Okay. The problem is that it was all about context, just like a lot of things. And I always tell people, my own critics that are feeding it right back to me, rightfully so, if I had had my rifle at the ready, okay, or let's even go,
let's go,
it was slung, okay. I mean, I'm still literally, you know, I just had my third cup of coffee, eating my beanie weenies and wearing my dry socks, right? And so. Let's just say, let's take it a step farther and say I had my rifle shouldered, and not at the low ready, but I'm in the high ready firing position, and I see this moving object, and I know that within 2 to 3 seconds it's going to step between those two trees at 80 yards, and I'm gonna get a solid ID on this object. If that had been the case, I still, because of the context of the situation, I wouldn't have been able to take a shot. I could have taken a shot.
Because you didn't know where I was.
Because I didn't know where Daryl was. And so I couldn't, in good conscience, make a shot.
Yeah. Well, it's... And I don't want to give the critics too much time here, but, you know, the critics will simultaneously say that, you know, we're jumping around and shooting at shadows and then also saying, well, you saw 36 Bigfoot and you didn't shoot any of them. And like, you can't have it both ways.
They're just wrong. I mean, they're just wrong. You know, they don't want to hear that, but they're wrong.
Alton, you had, how many times did you maybe see a wood ape this summer? Because you were down there. How many days was Alton down there?
43 days. Alton was in territory 43 days, and Alton had three or maybe four visuals. Yeah.
So of those, Alton, which one sort of comes to mind first?
Two of those were small creatures. They reminded me of chimps. We had the opportunity this summer to kind of send in reports of our activities and observations on a fairly regular basis every few days. We had either phones that had the right kind of boosters that we could get out, or we'd drive up to a place where we had phone access, and we'd phone Daryl and update him, or we'd email or text or send things to you. So two of the sightings that I had reminded me of basically chimpanzees, you know, blackish or black creatures. One of them was, we heard a loud, it was either a tree break or a large limb break, and Travis took off towards the bottleneck, and I was behind him, and I stopped and was just glassing the side of the mountain. And I saw just briefly, just for a flash, you know, this black creature that kind of ran down the mountain at an angle, and that was the last I saw of it. I mean, it was just a second or so. And so, you know, we reported this. And then when I was there for my five-day solo, I heard some knocking and racket down towards the property gate. And I went in that direction, and I saw a creature that confused me. It was black again. It had kind of reddish highlights on its hair. And I didn't get a good look at its head. I didn't notice a tail. I can't say it didn't have a tail, but I did not see a tail. It crawled off in a very strange fashion. I took off after to see if I could see it again, and I didn't relocate it. But the color, you know, this black kind of reddish tint combination, you know, didn't, and the size of the creature was like a large coon size. Those two observations taken, you know, independently, you know, could be dismissed, I guess. But then when Travis had his sighting that you'll talk to him about later, those two things made sense. They fit in. They all clicked. Yeah. So that's what I guess impressed me as far as the four sightings. But all four of them were interesting in their own ways. Again, this fits in Daryl's category of sightings that weren't certain. You know, I can't state unequivocally that's what I saw. An ape, but we were, Professor Leeper and I were involved with a situation where I was going to walk him to a position where he could overlook a large area, and then I continued on past him and then delayed for a while and came back. And as I was passing by his position, I heard some ruckus up ahead, some steps, three quick steps. And it was a heavy sound, three heavy, quick steps. And it was, I could tell it was going from my left to right. And I got kind of excited because I knew it was going to cross the road. But what I saw was this kind of dark brown creature that crossed the road so fast it literally was a blur. And I couldn't tell anything about it except color and relative size. And so that was interesting.
Relative size, how big do you think it was?
Well, Ken had me do a reenactment. He's really into doing Ken reenactments, Stewart. Ken Stewart. And so he had Travis go to the place where I saw it cross the road, and he and I stood where I saw it, which was about 40 yards, or 40 steps, I guess, about close to 40 yards. And Travis ran across, and of course, he running as fast as he could. It wasn't nearly as fast as what I'd seen. But the size also struck me. I saw Travis, and he looked small. I mean, he's 6'3", and he's a big man.
250 pounds.
250? It wouldn't surprise me. He's a large lad. And so that was interesting. When I ran up to see if I could locate it again after it blurred across the road, there was a loud commotion behind me, like at 8 o'clock or so. And so it distracted me. It succeeded in distracting me. I looked back to see if I could see it, and then it suddenly hit me. Maybe this is an intentional distraction behavior.
Away from the other one to cross.
Mm-hmm. So we've had that sort of thing. We've speculated, anyway, that that's what that was. A number of times when we've seen one or been close to one and we start to pursue it, something loud distracts us in an opposite direction.
I mean, think about that for just a minute. I mean, think about the last 30 years and all the documentaries and the movies and the shows and all everybody from the community and everything they've contributed to this endeavor. Okay, whether it be just armchair research or a full on in the field type stuff. But think about the concept of what Alton just said. I mean, we're a long way from weird travels and unsolved mysteries.
It's TV shows that the group has been on in the past.
I mean, if you really stop and think about it, this is incredible data.
Yeah. What's interesting about what he said, and when he said it struck me that we've actually had multiple cases where this happened over the past summer where, like, we've learned that tactic of theirs. So, like, when we're focused on one direction and we hear something in the other direction and we look, we go, or we focus our attention there, we think, oh no, this is what they're trying to do. And this is because we've experienced it so much. I mean, it's part of what we've learned.
I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, 4 or 5 years ago, it boggles my mind that we've come so far and it's all been by experience. It's not speculation. It's not conjecture. It's just it's literally on the ground, real life, experiences that have molded and it's very observable, repeated observations of this. And it's obviously a smart animal. We know that, but this is something that we can try to exploit.
Darrell, a couple of just number questions for you. This was Operation Tenacity. Right, I kept getting this one and the last one confused in my head. How many days total?
122.
How many investigators were on site over the course of that time?
41.
And that's a record. Last year it was not that many.
Last year I think it was 36. About 115 days, I think, last year. So, yeah, I mean, we're constantly trying to expand and we're trying to, to just increase our time in the field, the number of people. It would be wonderful if we could conduct a 6-month operation.
This gets back to the nobody else is doing this. I mean, there are things that we do tactically day to day that other people are doing out there. But this idea of putting 50 people in the field for almost 4 months, whatever it was. Yeah, I don't know. I've not heard of anyone doing that.
I don't mean that as a slam on any other researchers and what they're trying to do. It's just that we are gleaning observations and what I would call hard intel on these animals and their behaviors, and it's repeated from summer to summer, and it's just not that we're I'm not trying to brag. It's just that we're just trying to make it happen.
Yeah, I get you.
I'm just really proud of the membership that we have. They've gone, year after year, summer after summer, above and beyond, and they've dedicated their finances. They've dedicated their vacations to cooperating in these ventures, and it's just a remarkable testament to the quality that we have in our membership.
So next year, we're planning pretty much the same length of time.
Yeah, it's going to be roughly the same amount of time, maybe a little longer.
Now, one of the more controversial aspects of the things that we experienced this year was this whole business with trees. And when the last time I had you on the show, we had a handful of experiences where we had documented trees falling. We had the week that I was there, Bravo, we had the tree fall down. But then there was the week when I was on the phone with Ken Stewart and the tree came down. But now we're done. And it's remarkable. How many trees and or significant limb breaks did we document this year? You recall the specific number?
27.
27 trees. Was that both, or is that one?
That's just trees.
That's just trees. So the branches were similar, correct?
While we were there for 122 days, our investigators observed 27 tree falls.
These are big trees.
These are loud, obvious, cracking. I mean, you can't. We saw a number of them. We heard many. Probably heard. Yeah, we probably saw as many as we heard fall. And the last team, Quebec team, we saw a tree fall from 50, 60 yards. We saw the top of it. And we ran over there, and then what happened? You had a visual. Yeah. Oh, imagine that. Yeah. This tree just happens to fall out of the thin air, and then there's a wood ape over there. And I hear one running up the mountain, and then one throws a rock at the cabin. So
these are trees that fell in close proximity to the cabins.
Yes, within 100 yards.
You saw another one?
So I didn't want to get into it now, but yeah, the story there is that it was later in the evening. It was, I don't know,
it was 7:20.
7:20. So it wasn't dusk yet, but the sun was going down, and so the trees were silhouetted, and we were just sitting around the fire, and we actually had Daniel Falconer down there, and we were looking at Comic-Con pictures on his computer. And
out of nowhere,
yeah, out of nowhere, this tree starts to fall down, and I can see it in the distance because the sun is silhouetting behind these trees. I can see the tree fall. The top of it fell anyway. And so you...
Well, there was something I wanted to try on this team that we haven't done before, and that is anytime anything like this happened, just dead sprint to it. Because they're used to us, I assume, they're used to us creeping down the trail, trying to be quiet. So I just grabbed my weapon and I just hauled freaking ass. I mean, dead. And I'd been doing sprint training, So, I mean, I was ready and I sprinted. And
so you went in there. And so in the vicinity of where this tree had come down, or where part of this tree at least had come down, you heard.
Oh, yeah. Definite movement up the mountain. I feel confident one was going up the mountain.
Movement up the mountain. And there was a squirrel up there barking at it, whatever it was. So
Large rock displacement. I could hear the branches breaking as this thing's moving off. That's where I think it's gone.
Yeah, which it may have.
I'm yelling to you. He's gone up the mountain. Right. I can hear him. He's up the mountain. So we're 100-150 yards apart. Right. And then y'all yell to me.
Yeah, Daniel and I are on the road, and we're trying to find this tree. We never actually found it, but we were trying to find where this tree was. And some from behind us, from the the direction of the south, basically, we heard a wood knock. And it sounded like it was fairly close. So we're like, did you hear that? And we turn around, and I saw a flash of movement. I saw some kind of movement back there. And it was enough. And I was walking along the road when I saw it. So I stopped. And it's funny because Daniel was filming this with his little video camera. Yeah, and so he says, yeah, I saw it too. And so I sort of squat down and like stare in there. And when I stop moving and I'm looking right at it, it was the head and upper torso of a dark figure that ducked behind a tree. It was tree peeping, and that's what we saw. And then I start yelling over for you.
Daryl, we have an animal. And so I came over, and I pursued it.
Daniel said that. So we have an animal.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Daryl, we have an animal. And so I pursued it for probably 200 yards. Yes, I know you can't catch one on foot. Here's the whole thinking behind that: is that you're hoping to capitalize on a mistake. You're hoping that something's gonna happen. I mean, if you press it, oftentimes that's something you learn from the military. You press the fight, you just press it. Things can happen in your favor. So I just pressed it, chased it for 200 yards. I could hear it moving off. Never caught visual of it again. But it was a very exciting evening.
So this tree thing. Again, this is last time we had this conversation was early on. Now here we are at the end. Anybody have an idea why this? Because if we had 27 trees and 27 large branches, what have we typically heard?
Well, but that does not include limb branch breaking. Now, that's a separate quantitative event. The tree breaking, 27, and then branch and limb breaking, 21. So take all those and put those together. Do the math. 27 plus 21. That's how many times we heard some sort of part of a tree or the entire tree being broken, failed.
So why? What's going on?
I think it's a part of intimidation behavior. That's what I believe. I believe they're breaking vegetation. just like I said the last time we talked about this, Brian, it in terms of the forest, breaking a tree is a nuke. It's the loudest thing. It's the loudest thing that you can do to produce noise. And if these animals equate noise with power, then what better way than to break a 2-foot diameter tree, and create this humongous explosion of a sound.
All kinds of secondary sounds, too. Yeah, yeah. Alton, you want to pop in here?
Yeah, I think this idea of intimidation makes sense. I was in the valley once this summer with Dr. Ken Helmer, and he and I walked way towards the base of the South Mountain, the mountain that's south of the camp. And we positioned to where he was facing in one direction, and I was near him facing in the opposite direction. And we hadn't been there very long when down comes a tree, very close to us.
I heard it from my position.
Very close to us.
Yeah.
And when we were finally through with our sit, we went over to find the tree, and Ken saw where he said, a creature could have come up. There was like a path there, and he said, creature could have come up this path, pushed this tree over, and retreated, and I would have never seen it. So, here's an instance. We were far from the camp, yet we had a tree pushed over near our position.
40 yards from you, right? Wasn't it 40 yards?
It was very close. It might have been 30 to 40 yards. Yeah, maybe. It was close, right in front of Ken. So, to me, that makes sense. I mean, it's a huge coincidence, at the very least, but it makes sense to me in terms of, these things kind of following people around and pushing trees over. Kind of reminds me of our experience in Arkansas when we were when we were there years ago.
Again, it's a great noisemaker. I mean, I was there for that he's talking. That was Juliet team. I was about 300 yards to their north, and I heard it. It was a god-awful commotion. I couldn't tell that it was a tree from that distance. I just knew that something – I thought it was a big boulder or tree, something. So, I started going that way, but it was definitely a noisemaker. There's no doubt about it.
I'm paraphrasing that there's an old saying that if it happens once, it's chance. If it happens twice, it's a coincidence. If it happens three times, it's a conspiracy. Right. Right. Well, the fact remains that trees fall over in the woods. I mean, everybody knows that, and some people have been witness to that. And I think we could probably look back and think about all the times we've had in the valley prior to these missions and these operations, back when we were doing Operation Forest Vigil, where we might actually have heard a tree fall. Mm-hmm. And of course,
we never have.
Well,
never did.
I mean, I recall being down there in the past and having heard a tree fall and not putting two and two together. But I mean, let's just face facts here. I mean, are these really coincidences? I don't think so. I mean, something doesn't just push a tree over.
But you've also got all this other data along with that. You got rock throwing all in happening concurrently,
it's
almost.
It's about context.
Yeah.
It's about the totality of the circumstances of what goes on down there.
Well, and that context is what I was getting at a minute ago. I mean, we haven't observed this kind of behavior at this quantity in previous years, have we?
Not as it relates to tree breaks, tree falls. No. It's something that's I don't want to call it a new phenomenon, but it seems to have increased.
Right. Yeah. Well, we had one fall down during Foxtrot when I was there, but again, they were punctuations; they were few and far between.
I think they're pulling out the stops. They're as tired of us being in there as we are tired of not collecting a specimen. and they're literally thinking, how can we? Okay, we've thrown, jukebox sized boulders into the creek bed. We've done everything to try to scare these guys. We've body slammed cabins. We've done everything that we know as animals to show aggression to try to stave off this intruder. And I think that's what they're. I think that in the last four summers, obviously the tree breaking and the tree felling is not a new phenomenon, but it's just a more observed phenomenon. And I just Absolutely. Think it's just one more tool in their toolbox to say, hey, get out of our valley, I mean, who else can do that?
Brian, one other thing that is different.
Yeah, actually, somebody on the internet told me it was the Mexican drug cartel. So it could have been the Mexican drug cartel.
That would not be good for them.
No. one other difference is... for about a week or so, the apes upped their game in terms of rock throwing, because we had a number of quite large rocks that were thrown at the cabin this summer, and we hadn't seen that before.
Very large. I mean, the one that you were able to send photos of. I mean, that was larger than a bowling ball. I mean, it was a big old rock.
Yeah, that was thrown at my daughter. My daughter came in with me for our Juliet team, and we tried a sort of a lost camper scenario, where the rest of the teammates, Alton, led a team out, just out of the valley, away, get out of here, leave my daughter and my son-in-law there, seemingly alone, while I am inside the cabin, ready to take overwatch after I've slept. And shortly after Alton's team left, I'm in the cabin sleeping, just my daughter and my son-in-law are out. They start lobbing these big rocks, big, huge rocks, and of course it scared my daughter and my son-in-law, and plans sort of changed. Had to abort what we had planned, which was for them to sleep in a tent and for me to provide overwatch. They didn't want to sleep in the tent after, you know, all these rocks. And Jeff saw one peek around the woodshed. And so, yeah. So
I mean, think about that again. I mean, we're stepping up our game. We're constantly on, you know, trying to brainstorm and figure out new ideas that may sound silly or ridiculous. Or I mean, we're trying to outsmart them. And
absolutely.
And outflank them, and they're doing the same exact thing to us. It's incredible if you stop and think about it. The dynamic between us and them, and they always surprise us.
One of the interesting things we did this year that was different, one of these new tactics that we tried was you and I in the last week, Daryl. We tried a new tactic. Can you, why don't you describe? You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I call it a tailgate drop. That's where you take two guys out in a truck, pick up, and you go out of the valley. You drop them off, and then they hike in under cover of darkness at night. And that's what we did, Brian, you and I did. We hiked in from 3.5 to 4 miles west of the compound. We hiked in at night.
What time did you depart?
We left the drop zone at about 2200, and I think we got to the compound about 0100, 0130, something like that.
And it was we had no lights. The moon was full, but we used no lights when we were down there. I mean, we were trying to sneak in.
Yeah, and we did. We used no lights, absolutely no lights. We had an encounter on the way down, halfway down, and then we proceeded down into the compound. And the team that was there, which was Alton was a part of, Bob and Kathy Strang, Daniel Falconer, they created this tremendous diversion, made all manner of noise, and you know, playing loud music, blowing on stadium air horns, all sorts of things, and I couldn't even hear my own steps.
With the idea that they would distract attention away from us, because then we were close at that point. We wanted to get in a position.
Yeah, and that allowed us to slip in, hopefully unnoticed, and we have every reason to believe that we did get in there unnoticed, and that would put us in a position to be able to collect a specimen. We got into position, and we began hearing wood knocks and bangs, but we were just not in the right position. So the tailgate drop is definitely an interesting tactic, and we're going to try it. We're going to expand it, and we're going to try it repeatedly next year.
So it's you mentioned briefly that we had an encounter going down, and that was an interesting encounter to me, because I thought at that point we had been busted, you know, by potentially an animal acting as a sentry. Why don't you describe what that encounter was like for us?
Well, we were about halfway down the mountain. The thing is, at the drop area, the drop zone, we actually smelled what we believed was an animal. Like, there was one waiting, because we have reason to believe they follow vehicles out to a point about 3.5 to 4 miles west of the compound. That they have sentries, and they just like chimps, they, you know, gorillas do the same thing. We have reason to believe they follow vehicles out. So when we got back to this area, we smelled what we were certain was an ape. After Bob Strang took the truck and left us there, the smell left, which was indicative of an animal leaving. We no longer smelled it. So we began the hike down a little after 10 p.m., 2200, and we got about halfway down, and we smelled the smell again, really strong, really. Yeah.
And I'll say, I've never smelled it. The first time, you always smell this stuff first because you have this amazing nose, but the first time it was strong, but the second time it was like a wall of odor that just wafted over us.
Yeah, it was the strongest I've smelled in several years now. I haven't smelled one that strongly, I think in 3 years. And I mean, it smelled like he was right next to me. And then something was thrown at us. And so then I hit the dirt. I got down in the trail, which is more like a ravine. And Brian got his third gen out, and he just began scoping. And that's when he saw a figure dart from tree to tree to tree, being backlit by the moon. And then the smell was gone, and that was it. It was gone.
And actually, it wasn't even with the night vision. I saw it with my eyes because the moon was so bright. The trees were glowing. They were just reflecting the white moonlight, so they were glowing white. And there was a upright shadow, a black figure that walked in front of a few of them, going from left to right. And so, but if that was an animal, I don't know what else it would have been. There was no indication when we got down there, and we stayed in position for hours. We stayed in position till daylight. We had no indication that any animal near the compound knew we were there.
Yeah, nothing approached us. Yeah, we were there. We were out all night. From 2200 till I think we went to bed the next morning at 10 a.m. thereabouts. We were out all night, and nothing ever came within close proximity to us. Nothing approached us. All their attention seemed to be focused on the cabins. Yeah. There was banging and wood knocks from the direction of the central cabin where we stay, and so we had every reason to believe that their attention was focused on Alton's team there at the cabin and not us, which led you and I to believe confidently that we went in there unobserved, and so we're going to try that again, and we're going to try to capitalize on that.
It gets back to that, you know, we like to joke that they're forest ninjas, but they're not omnipotent. They don't know everything that's happened.
Forest ninjas, that's a good name. They are forest ninjas. That is, I mean, they're extremely, extremely aware of their environment, but they are not perfect. They're not perfect. You know, they can't be everywhere, and they do have weaknesses, and they are fallible creatures.
Brian, can I say something about the smell? Over the last, you know, 4 or 5 years, I've caught when we thought we busted one. When we pulled a similar tactic a few years ago, we came in on the the bad boy buggy, right, the flanker. And that was the first time I actually smelled the smell. But this last summer, we were sitting in the middle of the camp in the middle of the day. And try to imagine, you know, spending a few days or even a week out in the woods. You get used to some of the forest smells, the dirt, you know, campfire, certain foliage. And then imagine all of a sudden you're smelling a hot, warm apple pie fresh out of the oven. That is a smell that you're immediately going to recognize. That is something that it doesn't fit in here, right? And when I was down there, for the first time ever, I caught a smell, a very strong, completely distinct smell of zoo. I smelled a zoo, and it was
like the eighth section of the zoo.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And it was like, and it hit me for about 2 seconds, and then it was gone. And I didn't smell it again the entire week. But it was so strong and so distinct in my mind that it was unmistakable. Yeah. Just like smelling apple pie, you know, in a steel smelter, you know, or you recognize it as something that doesn't belong there, but you definitely recognize it as distinct as something. Yeah. And that's the first time ever that I've had that smell, and there was no question that it was a zoo-like smell, and it didn't belong in that forest.
And like I said, the second time we smelled it, it was almost physical. I mean, it was so powerful. It was just like somebody turned on a light switch and boom, you were filled with this intense, sweaty ape smell. I mean, I don't know if I've told the story on the show or not, but the smelling the gorilla at the St. Paul Zoo, and the wind turned and he was sitting there, and all of a sudden I smelled him and the hair on my neck went up because it was just like involuntarily, like, oh, I know that, right?
America.
Right, I know what that animal smells like, right? So we've been talking for a little while now, and I want to get to a few other folks here. But so what? Looking forward to next year, as always. Closing thoughts on this year and opening thoughts for next year?
I'll say we're going to stay in the fight. I mean, that's stay in the fight. Press forward and just keep, you know, let's just make it happen. We're not quitting. We can't quit now. We've got too much invested. We've learned too much. Yeah. So it's either going to happen or it's not.
We have a responsibility now. We absolutely have a responsibility to follow through with this. We have an ethical responsibility, I think, because we know this animal's real, and most of the world scoffs at it. And, you know, I think that if we don't act quickly, if we don't have a critical urgency, I believe that the animal is probably going to go extinct. But I do want to say that we came close again this year. We did have opportunities to get this done. The luck was not on our side again. But as the lesson from Jim Corbett was applied today, Corbett himself said you have to stay with it, that luck does eventually turn your way, that there will be many, 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 many times that luck will not go your way, and you will think that you can't do it one more day or one more year, one more month, but you must continue to press forward. You must continue the work. The last team, you and I had a shot. Had he stood there for one more second, I would have sent around. I would have put the red dot on it. I would have sent around, and it may have been over. That was the next to the last night. And so that's how close we're coming. And so, we're definitely not giving up. And, you know, critics be damned. We are pressing forward, and we're going to do this. And, you know, I'm 53, man, and I'm in great condition. And we've still got a long time that we're going to be around, and we're not going anywhere.
We have the team to complete our objective, and planning has already begun for next year.
That's it. All right. Succinct. Thanks, guys. Okay, so we're still outside here, and the sunset has turned to night, and the wind is blowing. It's a little chilly, actually, even though I'm from Minnesota. I will admit to being a little cold right now. Stars are coming out. But I have Gene and Travis and Shannon here, and we're going to talk about some of the experiences they had in X over the summer. And the first thing I want to talk to, I want to sort of ease into this, and I want to talk to you, Travis, very briefly about something we tried when we were down there together. We called it the haunted cabin tactic, where we left you. It looked like we completely left the area, and the idea was we were going to leave you behind in the cabin, quiet, and then you would be able to assume overwatch when the sun went down, with the perception for anyone outside that there was nobody left in the cabin. That didn't really work out. What happened?
Yeah, it was a nice, innovative idea because it's not something we'd tried before. Basically, did we start about sundown? Is that when we started, or a little bit before sundown? Y'all all sort of packed things in your truck, and I went and sort of hid in the cabin while y'all were packing things, and then y'all took off, and there were no vehicles in the compound, and I was there by myself. And what my plan was to get a little shut-eye until after dark, till 9, 10 o'clock, whatever I could get, and then sneak up to the overwatch tent and do overwatch all night long and let the apes think that there was no one in the valley, because we've always had questions about what happens around that cabin whenever none of us are there. You know, we wonder, do the apes just walk around like they own the place, because they pretty much do, because nobody's there? And we've had those questions, and we don't have any way of verifying that without having somebody there to witness it. And we thought it would be a good collection opportunity, albeit a little bit risky having somebody there by themselves. But where y'all were parked whenever y'all went out was only about 3 miles away. So we were hoping that if I did have a collection opportunity and I did fire, we were hoping y'all would hear the shot and you would be able to come back and, you know, help me out. So I'm not just down there by myself with, you know, whatever befalls, whatever happens in that situation. But so y'all left, I want to say, I don't know, 8:30 or something. Actually, I think it was a little bit later than what I said, because it gets dark about 8:45, 9 o'clock. I think y'all left a little bit later than that, 8:30 or so. And I went, and I was already laying down in the back portion of the cabin. And I was laying on the floor away from the windows on a sleeping pad, hoping to just catch a few hours of sleep, like I said. And while I was laying there, I found it difficult to fall asleep, because now I was there alone. And I had all these things running through my head about what would happen, you know, if I did get a collection opportunity. And I was slightly nervous, to be honest, about doing that overwatch by myself, about the whole idea. You know, I was willing to do it. I was game, but I was a little nervous about it. And I wasn't there maybe 10 minutes after y'all left, and I heard a rock hit the roof. And this summer was a little bit different on the rock throwing. There wasn't a whole lot of rock throwing on the immediate cabin that we were staying in, you know, but this was an obvious rock that hit the roof. And it was while I was in the back portion of the cabin laying on the floor, and I was like, okay, that was a rock. And just a couple minutes after that rock hit, I heard obvious heavy movement on the slope just north of me outside the window. The window was open. And it was probably 25, 30 yards away from me. but it was obviously a large animal moving around. And I heard it come a little bit closer to the cabin, down the slope a little bit. And then a couple minutes later, I heard it move off back up the slope. And at that point, it was just about getting dark, and I was like, well, I'm still going to try to get some sleep. So I laid there about 30 more minutes, and I didn't get any sleep. I wasn't able to fall asleep because I was too keyed up about the situation, about the prospect of what might happen because of what just did happen. I was pretty sure that was an ape that I just heard walk away behind the cabin because he'd just thrown a rock a couple minutes earlier. And so when I decided that I wasn't going to get any sleep, I went ahead and snuck up to the Overwatch tent. I'd already had everything set up ahead of time. I had the rifle up in the Overwatch tent. I had my headlamp there beside me, even though I had no plans to use it. That was just there in case, and I had nothing but my sidearm down where I was. But I pretty much crawled all the way across the cabin. It took me several minutes because I was trying my hardest not to make any sounds, not to let any apes know anybody was there. And I creeped all the way over to the Overwatch tent, and I climbed up in there, effectively not making any noise, I think. And I managed to shut myself in there, and I assumed Overwatch. And I don't remember exactly how long I was on Overwatch, but I want to say about an hour and a half, and I heard absolutely nothing. I heard no movement on the slope anymore, no rocks hit our cabin or any other cabin, no vocalizations, no wood knocks, no nothing. And after about an hour and a half of nothing, it started to sprinkle lightly, and just it came on like an onslaught. It just started raining harder and harder and harder. And the Overwatch tent, the way it's set up right now, it's not totally waterproof. And I started getting water falling on me. And, you know, I've got a $6,000 thermal scope mounted on my 4570. And so I was like, I don't want this thing to get wet. So I crawled back down and I went inside the cabin. And I was like, I'll sleep for a little bit. And, you know, if the rain lets up, then I'll go assume Overwatch again because I can't sit up there right now. It's too wet. So I went back down and I fell asleep. And I set an alarm on my phone for like 2 hours later. And I woke up then, and it was still raining real hard, so I went back to sleep. And the next time I woke up, it was daylight. And it was still raining lightly, if I remember correctly, at daylight. And y'all came down there quickly at daylight. I think y'all got back down to the cabin at like 7 or something. And, you know, it was a real telling situation that nothing else happened. You know, I don't think any of us anticipated that to happen, that nothing else would happen. But, you know, in hindsight, I think it makes sense because I think our cabin was under direct surveillance from an ape that was up on the slope, and he saw y'all leave, so he was just sort of testing the waters, make sure everybody's gone. I'm going to hit the cabin with a rock. I don't hear any sounds at the cabin. Yeah, everybody's gone. Okay, I'm gone.
And they walk around like they own the place, but no, not there. They walk around somewhere else.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. If none of us are at the cabins, why would they be there? Right. So they just walk off and, you know, go tend to their own needs because they don't have to worry about watching us anymore because right. We're not there. So it makes perfect sense that that's what happened.
He was happy because he had an early shift. He could take off. Yeah. So, Shannon, you were down there. What team were you in when you had your two experiences?
I was with Charlie team. It was the first week of June over that Memorial Day weekend into the first week of June.
So two things happened to you, and one of which I find fascinating, the thing that sort of crept up on you and Mark. Why don't you sort of relate to me the tale there?
So we got in about 7:50 on Sunday evening. We had arrived and kind of heard a weird noise on arrival when we were unloading the vehicle, something like a siren, almost like a klaxon sound, and all of us, gee, that was weird, you know. Kind of sat around the fire pit. It was a very low fire, just embers. And we kept hearing stuff in that middle woods bottleneck area. About 1 a.m., Mark McClarkin said, are you okay with going out there and kneeling in the bottleneck? And I think he said it was a waxing moon. I just remember it being pitch black. Right. And I'm like, I can't see anything. You're going to have to... You know, he's like, I have great night vision. So basically I put my left hand on his right shoulder and I had my shotgun in the right hand and we walked out about midway through where that little stump is where we feed Foxy.
So his plan is to basically go over there in the pitch dark and just take a knee and wait.
Right. So we take a knee and I'm closest to the middle wood side and we take a knee and Shannon Mason actually came up behind us. She had a Gen 1 night vision monocle that was giving off ambient light, had some bright, like, bone-colored white North Face pants on, and he what's going on? And he told her, and, you know, she quietly went back to the fire area. We took an in. It didn't take long. You could hear crunch, 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 crunch. And
from the direction of what we call the middle woods.
Yeah. Again, pitch black. And I'm on a knee, right hand, you know, shotgun stabilizing me. We're sitting there. And I don't know, you know, I grew up deer hunting, but I don't know an animal that strategically moves when the wind blows.
Right. And that's the crazy thing. It's like when the wind wouldn't blow, you wouldn't hear anything. The wind would rustle, and then.
So, and all your senses, because you can't see, are so, you know, hearing. And I just remember being like a tuning fork, because this thing kept getting progressively closer, and it was going to hit me before it hit Mark.
It got pretty darn close.
I would say within arm's length. And it's like, okay. And he said, can you smell it? And, you know, even though everything is heightened, I couldn't smell it. I've smelled the zoo smell, that manure-y yeah. smell, but I wasn't smelling it. But I could damn sure hear it. Mm-hmm. Crunch, 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 crunch. And it's like, okay, who's going to make the first move? Yeah. And then all of a sudden, Mark just... And it stopped. It didn't, like, bolt away. It just slowly... retreated, and I said, okay, I'm ready to go back now.
So then you guys got up and walked back.
We walked back to the campfire. Not long after that, he had gone to go to the bathroom at the outhouse, and I had the TIM, which is the older thermal unit, more black and white image. And he had come out of the outhouse, and all of a sudden I saw him draw his sidearm. Number one, the thing that sticks out is a human lights up like a Las Vegas strip on the TIM or anything. And you just, I mean, clearly see him draw his sidearm. And both myself and Justin Horn said, okay, everybody, lights on. What's going on? Something had growled at him from that middle woods area. Yeah.
How much longer after that do you think that was?
Maybe 15 minutes.
Okay, so pretty shortly thereafter.
Pretty quickly. Mm-hmm.
And then anything else happened that night, or is that pretty much it?
I think that was about it.
And then the next thing you know I want to talk about, was that when was that in relation to these events?
So that we arrived on Sunday, so it was Tuesday about 11:30. Reading over the notes, we had heard movement in that middle woods area again. And I like to take laps of the compound when I'm there and change up the direction each time. And this time we headed east, toward the east cabin, through that meadow down into the bottleneck area. And we weren't really being stealthy. It was myself and Shannon Mason. I was point. She was about 5 yards behind me, and the ground was moist. And I remember there was a lot of deer track. We were talking about all the tracks, and we were coming in that bottleneck spot where it starts to open up toward the east cabin, and I saw something bolt across the trail from south to north, head toward the north mountain. Correct. And it was at least as large as me, dark brown, red. And
large as you, you're 8.5 feet tall, is that?
No. Whatever it was, I got the impression that it was the same mass as me. I mean, it was a fleeting look, but whatever it was glided across my vision, across that trail, and it didn't make any noise.
Right.
So I was just stunned at first, because it's like I didn't hear this thing.
And you thought it was sort of like bent over at the waist.
I got the impression that it was stooped at the waist. Yeah. I couldn't tell if it was quadrupedally, you know, locomoting across or on... you know, biped. It was so smooth and so fast.
Yeah. That sounds vaguely familiar to me. So smooth, super fast, and not making any sound whatsoever.
Not making any sound whatsoever. And I I just stopped, and then I just started cussing. And Shannon Mason, what? I'm like, I just saw something bolt across the trail at me, and she kind of came up behind me with her sidearm drawn, and I'm like, there's no way in hell we're gonna catch this thing. It was just stunning how fast and smooth it was and how quiet. And then we heard a large limb snap on the north mountainside. And then I saw a whitetail flush east across the creek. Two totally different colors, sizes. This thing was smooth. It didn't lumber like a bear. I mean, it was like it was on a zip line.
So could you estimate what was the amount of feet that, you know, linear feet that you saw it exposed to you when it darted across the path?
It was 50 yards ahead of me, and I only saw it for a second to a second and a half.
Okay, so just it cleared that it was probably...
I mean, it was if we were watching Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, it was a character that got pulled across on a line. Right. That smooth.
Right. Yep, I know what you're talking about. Cool. Well, thank you. That was cool. So back to you, Travis. You guys had another experience, and I'll say up front that I think this is, and I said it when I first heard this, that I think it's one of the most significant things we've experienced down there. But why don't you, you and Gene, were down there, and why don't you sort of just set the stage here for what happened?
Okay, this was during my team, and I was there with Gene and David and Andrew. Was Andrew there that week? Yeah. And we had been hearing relentless wood knocks to our southeast, and that's kind of odd because we haven't heard just a ton of wood knocks from that direction, and it was just like a motif for that week as we were hearing constant wood knocks from this one location to the southeast, and they all sounded like they were from the same exact spot. They were about the same volume, and, you know, it was like we'd heard 10 or 15 of them so far that week. And one of the things that frustrates me to no end about these animals is our inability to find sign of them, other than, you know, occasional tracks. Mm-hmm. And occasional on those trackways you find logs that have been stepped on that you're like, something really heavy stepped on that. But we don't find, like, browsing sign from them, and we don't find trees that they've beat up on these wood knocks and things like that, except for one time back during Operation Endurance. And I've always thought that, you know, if they really are hitting trees with pieces of wood to make these sounds, which I think they are, we ought to find more sign of them doing that, because if you do hit a tree with a baseball bat or something, it leaves a wound on it. And I was just talking to Gene, and I was like, there's obviously a tree like 100 yards over there that's all beat to hell from this week. So let's go over there and find it. And this was like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And we just decided to go over there and look specifically for the tree that had been getting hit over there.
This is an interesting area, because when you told me where you went, this is a place that even though it's not very far from where the cabins are, it's in sort of a little corner that we don't often get into.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to get to the spot because you have to kind of hop across rocks on the creek to get there. And it's not on the way to get to anywhere. You know, if you're going to go that direction to get somewhere, it's easier to go around it. Right. So it's not very far from the compound, but it's not somewhere we go very often, just because it's hard to get to and it's not on the way to anywhere. It's kind of like people say small towns in East Texas. If you end up in this little town, you either have business there or you're lost.
Right.
And the only reason we would have gone back there is because we had business there. And our business there was to go find this tree that had gotten beat up so badly that week. So we went looking for that tree, and we had to find a spot where we could cross the creek. And this was an area to the south of what we call the East Cabin. And we were walking along in those woods very slowly. We were literally walking from tree to tree. Every tree we could find back there that was big enough that looked like it would produce a wood knock. And Gene and I were just walking up to this tree, kind of feeling of the bark, looking to see if we could see any strike marks on it, because I really wanted to find evidence of the wood knocking tree back there. And we were moving along real slowly. We weren't hunting by any means. You know, I didn't have my rifle in the low ready because I was looking at all the trees. And we were just walking back and forth, and I think Gene actually sort of, you know, prophetically called it as we were going back there, because we found pieces of trash back there, and Gene said something like, there's all kinds of things to play with back here. You remember that, Gene?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what kind of, this is a piece of the story I had not remembered. What were you finding on the ground there, Gene?
Trash pile or something, wasn't it? Rusted pans or something from like somebody threw trash out.
Yeah, it's not too far from this area we call the homestead, where there used to be a home back there. And in that area where there's a home, there's little pieces of trash laying around. There's some bottles and, you know, things like that. And there was just some, like Gene said, some old metal pans and things like that laying around the place. And he said something like, there's all kinds of things to play with around here, because there was lots of things laying on the ground. And as we were walking back and forth in there looking at trees, we were about 75 yards south of the East Cabin. And as we were walking through there, I was like mid-step, and I thought I heard a real subtle kind of sound as I was walking through. And the sound was so subtle that it made me stop and look to my east where I thought it came from, but it was such a quiet sound that I wasn't even sure totally that I heard anything. You know, maybe I was like, maybe it was a nut falling and it hit a leaf or something. Like, it was a real subtle sound, but it sounded like a real quiet huff. And I just stopped and I stared to the east for about 10 seconds, and I didn't see anything over there, and I didn't hear anything over there, and I can't see very far over there anyways, you know, maybe 15 yards because the woods are so thick. And I didn't say anything to Gene because he wasn't standing right beside me and because I wasn't totally sure that I'd heard something significant. So I just kind of went back to doing what I was doing. I started looking at the trees around me again, and about 5 or 10 seconds later, I heard a sound like claws on tree bark, or like if you were to rub a rough hand down tree bark, mm-hmm. kind of like the sound a squirrel makes whenever he's jumping off a tree or something. Not necessarily claws, but just the sound like a rubbing on tree bark. Sure. And I looked over to the east as soon as I heard that sound, and I saw some small animal moving through the grass. And as soon as I saw it, my first thought was that it was a raccoon. Because it was a very small animal, and if you just picture grass and brush that's like 2 to 3 feet high, it was moving through that. It wasn't running by any means, but it was moving through it pretty quickly. And about the time I saw it, it was just kind of in the shade, and because it was in the thick trees, and it was dark, just dark colored. I couldn't tell exactly what color it was. It just looked dark. And about that time, I could see that there was more than one. And I said, "Gene, look at that." And Gene looked up and saw them, and about that time it moved through a little piece of sunlight. And as soon as it moved through that piece of sunlight, I could see that it was this real strange color. It was a reddish black is the best way I could describe it. I went to Vermont just a couple weeks before this, and I saw a fissure up there. And that fissure was about the same color, it wasn't really brown, I can't call it, but just an auburn red black.
Yeah, it's like a black fur with a red tinge to it.
Yeah, if you just mix black and red fur together, that's what it looked like. And as soon as I saw it right there, I thought it was a hog, which is kind of a stupid thought looking back on it, because we've never seen any hogs in there. You know, we have like one game camera picture of a hog. They can't really live back there because the ground's so hard and they can't root. But that's just what I thought it was, because hogs can be sort of that color. But that's just the first thing that popped into my mind. That's the little box my mind put it in, because it was small, too. And as soon as I thought that, I took a step kind of to my right so that I could see them better. About that time, these couple animals, you know, I didn't know how many there were, they had made their way to a creek and they were fleeing to the east. And I just took a couple steps like to my right, and I caught a visual of them fleeing to the east. And before I tell what they looked like, I want Gene to tell what he saw, because he didn't see them after that point. What did you see, Gene?
Well, Travis saw four, and by that time, I had got up there within 4 or 5 feet of him, and when he said, "Look," there was a gap over there about 5 feet wide where I could see, and one of them went through that 5-foot gap, and I saw the top of his back. It just it was like a dark chocolate lab color to me. I didn't see a head or a tail. I just saw the back, and he was moving east.
And, how big do you think this was, like relative to – other little animals?
Bigger than a raccoon, I would say.
Bigger than a raccoon. That's not real big, though. I mean, that's not a big animal.
30, 40. Yeah, a raccoon can get up 35 okay. pounds.
Okay. So, four.
Yeah, I said 30 pounds or so when we first saw it. We said definitely less than 50 pounds because, like I said, as soon as I saw it, I thought it was a raccoon. And, Gene, you've seen tons of animals. You know, is there moving? Like, as soon as you saw it move, could you say what you thought it was?
Oh, there's nothing in there that color in that valley that I know of.
Yeah, so you saw the color before I did, I guess, or before you could make a preconceived notion about what it was.
All I know is it wasn't long hair. I mean, it was maybe 1 inch long hair, something like that.
Yeah, anyways, I took a couple steps. I sort of took a big step to my right so that I could see up this creek. Is these animals were running away. And as soon as I did that, I was just blown away instantly because there was these obviously simian-looking animals running up the creek on all fours. And as soon as I saw them, I realized real quickly what they were. And by that time, they were all gone because, you know, that's what happens.
Right.
That's the common theme about lots of these things is you think it's something else. And then as soon as you realize what it is, it's gone. And that collection opportunity is lost. But, I mean, these things, they if you just imagine small chimpanzees running away in a straight line. That's exactly what they look like. Like Gene said, I didn't see a head or tail. All I could see was shoulders and like the upper part of their bodies. But it was so strange seeing something whose shoulders were outward facing rather than downward facing, you know, like dogs and cats and things like that. Because just the way it was shaped, it was running away. It couldn't be mistaken for anything else. You know, I've seen bear cubs in there, and I've seen, of course, raccoons and things like that running away. And they don't have that shape to them where their shoulders are wider than their waist. Right. And these things were running away on all fours. They weren't just booking it full speed by any means, but they were kind of a hurried getaway kind of pace, mm-hmm. as they were getting away. And about the time I realized what they were all gone. And it was four of them that were running in a straight line.
So why I think this is so important, and I'm not a biologist, I don't even play one on TV, but the little that I do know is that, you know, these animals, if you want to use gorillas as a parallel, you know, producing young, caring for young, having that's a resource intensive activity, right? And it ties down certain members of the group because you have the of course the mothers of the group, but then you have sort of these other animals that are assisting, and you have fathers, and the idea that there would be four, all presumably around the same age because they're all about the same size. Did they all appear to be about the same size to you?
Yeah, they all did appear to be about the same size.
So I would guess that they're about the same age, and if you want to extrapolate that primates generally, you know, gorillas and humans have you know, single births to most of the time.
Yeah.
This could mean that there's four mothers in there all having offspring at the same time. And to me, again, I'm not a biologist. I don't know the algorithm. I don't know what the calculation is to get to the total number. But it's a hell of a lot bigger number than I ever thought could be in there. You know what I'm talking about?
I do know, and it is a very exciting thing. Like you said, it's probably the most significant visual we've ever had. And like you, I'm not a primatologist, and I won't pretend to play one. But I know that... The simians and us humans, of course, we don't have mating seasons like other animals do. So it might seem kind of odd that you would see four of them the same age, because obviously a mother didn't have quadruplets. I mean, we assume that that's not the case.
Right.
Yeah. But, you know, perhaps if you have a bunch of females around each other, they would ovulate together, sort of like
right.
humans
right.
tend to do.
Right.
So maybe that was the case. But, you know, it's an incredible experience. You know, I won't lie and pretend like I saw them really well, because I didn't see them that well. But it was obviously four little apes.
Yeah.
I mean, it could not have been anything else.
They were not bears. They were not bear cubs.
Yeah, I've seen bear cubs in there. And for one, they're not that color. And for two, they just don't have that shape. And, you know, I didn't explain too much about what happened initially. So let me do that right now. So I heard the huff. And then I heard the little scratching sound on the tree, and that's what caused me to turn around. If I hadn't have heard those two things, then we would have never seen these four animals, because we never heard them, or at least I never heard them. Did you hear them, Gene?
No, I didn't hear anything. I didn't even hear the hoof. I didn't hear them climb down the tree or anything.
Yeah, I heard both of those things, and if it wasn't for me hearing those things, then I would not have turned around and seen them, because I never heard them as they were running off. But in hindsight, looking back at this, we think, why would we hear a huff? And then hear the tree scratching sound, and then see all four of them running off. And what I think happened is that those four little apes were up in a tree, and there was a mother somewhere to my east, you know, 20, 30 yards away, far enough away that she was behind brush and I couldn't see her. And she knew that this was a bad situation, because there were four little apes up in this tree not far from us. This tree was only like 15 yards from where we were standing.
Mm-hmm.
And she knew that there was the babies that she was watching over, however that works. I won't pretend to understand the social dynamics of any great apes, much less this great ape, because nobody understands those things, because we don't have qualified boots on the ground to learn those types of things yet. But what we think happened, or what I think happened, is that she was letting them know that they need to get down and they need to run. And she made that real quiet little sound that I wasn't supposed to hear, that I did hear. And then I happened to hear one of them make a little mistake as he was jumping off the tree. And then I could see them bobbing through the grass. And I took a couple steps to my right, and I was able to see all four of them. And I'm thankful that I was able to see that, even though I couldn't capitalize on it.
Yeah. Now, I'm super jealous. It's like I said, it's one of the coolest things we've seen in there. And I think it's really significant. Well, thanks a lot, guys. Thanks for sitting out here in the wind and the cold and talking to me. I really appreciate it.
In biology, an area where there still exists a relic population of an animal, that is, the remaining population of a species that had, at an earlier time, a much larger range, that's called a refugium. Refugia can be quite small, like the north-facing slope of a mountain, for example, or the bottom of a deep ravine, or a secluded and sparsely populated corner of the Ouachita Mountains. Members of the NAWAC are increasingly of the opinion that the valley we call X is a refugium for the North American wood ape. Besides the significant encounter by Travis and Gene of four presumably very young apes, the number of sightings we've recorded of other similarly described creatures and pairs of animals moving together is relatively high. Sometimes the pairs seem to be one mature animal and one smaller one, while at other times they seem to be a mature pair. We can't know their social structure, of course, but the apes in X appear to be quite gregarious and potentially fairly numerous. It's possible that at an earlier time in the history of North America, situations like that found in X could have existed over a far larger scope. Perhaps back in the time when the only other primates inhabiting the vast wooded areas of the continent were Native Americans, and while of course they existed in larger numbers than what's commonly believed, they certainly were not counted in the hundreds of millions as people are today. It's possible there were hundreds or even thousands of X's throughout the Ouachitas and Ozark Ranges, down along the Red Mississippi Rivers and into the bayous of present-day Louisiana. And over time, as Europeans moved into the region and developed their own civilization and exploited the resources they found in ways no other people had before them, that the wood ape population was fragmented and isolated. Today, the NAWAC has reports from and has conducted investigations in areas like the mountains north of the Red River where X is, to the jungle-like Big Thicket region of East Texas, to the swampy lowlands around Caddo Lake. And of course, in between all of those, you'll find a little place called Fauk. Of course, without a persistent and dedicated field investigation, it's impossible to know which encounter was the sign of a refugium population and which was just a transient animal trying to scratch out an existence on its own. I personally believe that the majority of sightings reported by witnesses are of the latter kind, that is, individuals no longer able to live among those they came from or looking to branch out and start their own troops. It's not unlike how gorillas live. Again, this is pure speculation on my part, but many of the commonly held perceptions of wood apes do not line up with what the NAWAC continues to experience in X. In any event, nothing from the past summer's efforts has done anything but cause the NAWAC to feel an even greater urgency for protection of the animal's habitat. And as I said in the introduction to episode 54, there's really no way to know how many X's there are left, not without a concerted effort to find them. And while I think that's sufficient motivation to continue to strive for the collection of a holotype, it's also sufficient motivation for anyone hearing my voice to get involved at some level in the conservation effort. As we discussed in episode 60 with David Michizewski, there are many active groups already working to protect wood apes and their habitat, even if they don't acknowledge the creature's existence. David's National Wildlife Federation, for example, or the Nature Conservancy, or large national groups that spring to mind immediately. There are likely some in your local area doing the same kind of work at a more modest level. What's required right now, more than anything, is for people to get involved somehow to make sure that the areas we still have where large animals can live and reproduce remain as they are. Because if we don't, you and I and all the others who care about and love our wild places, who will? And if we don't do it today, when are we going to do it?